Good day, everyone. Welcome and thank you for joining today's Teneo Insights webinar. I'm Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo Political Risk Advisory in New York City. 1,378 days ago, the 2020 election campaign began when Donald Trump filed his re-election paperwork with the Federal Election Commission just a few hours after he was inaugurated. And 5 days from now, we will know, well, it's unclear what we'll know on November 3rd, Election Day. But what we do know is that so far, over 75 million early votes have been cast, either by mail or early in-person voting. And as we suggested, as my colleague Orson Porter suggested on one of these calls a few weeks ago, well over 50% of the total 2016 vote tally has already been rendered, and we've got five more days before Election Day itself. And, you know, while this election will be remembered for it, for its duration, certainly the amount of money spent, the tone, the polarization, the most impactful variable is likely to be that it has been carried out in the midst of a pandemic that is currently raging toward a third peak. Over 500,000 new cases in the past week, over 70,000 cases per day, and we're trending now at about 800 COVID-specific deaths per day on average, and we're over 1,000 yesterday. So today we're here to discuss the election, what next week might look like, and some of what we might think about going forward. And I'm joined today by two guests for this important discussion. Jerry Baker, he's a columnist and editor at large at the Wall Street Journal, where he was previously the editor in chief, as well as at Dow Jones. He's the host of Wall Street Journal at Large with Jerry Baker on the Fox Business Network. And previously, he was U.S. editor of the Times of London and Washington Bureau chief and chief U.S. commentator for the Financial Times. I'm also joined by my colleague and familiar to many of you on this call, Orson Porter. Orson's a Teneo senior managing director. He's the head of our DC office and heads up our government affairs practice. Previously, he was U.S. director of government and public affairs for Nike. And before that, he served in the White House as special assistant to President Bill Clinton. And if you want to play the do a shot game on this call today, I'd say do one every time Orson mentions his home state of Wisconsin. If you have a question for either guest, please submit via the moderator chat icon on your screen. So, okay, Orson, let me start with you. We're 5 days out. Give us the latest update on the state of play as you see it and what we should expect to see from the candidates and the campaigns over these last few days and how we should interpret that. You know, the president who has been fighting a rearguard action from the sound of it for most of this period, got a couple shots in the arm this week, first with the Supreme Court confirmation and seating earlier this week. And now, just moments ago, third quarter GDP is going to come in and came in at a huge number of 33.1% Q on Q. But we all know what that really means. But nonetheless, it'll be a number he can hang his hat on. So how do you see it, and what do you, and feel free to give us your bottom line on the race and the potential Senate balance.
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. And I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts. More importantly, I want to wish everyone a happy election, and hopefully those taking time to join us today are healthy and safe during these times of crisis. You mentioned 5 days. To put it a little simpler, you know, and to think about a sense of urgency, it's a mere 120 hours, which is nothing in some circles, but in politics could be a lifetime, and a lot could happen over the course of the next 4 to 5 days. As I have said in the past and will continue to say, elections really aren't that hard to figure out. At the end of the day, the beginning and the middle of the day, it's all about adding, not subtracting. And right now, the candidate that can find ways to reach the magic number of 270 for the electoral votes will be the victor. It isn't about the popular vote. Keep in mind that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by nearly 3 million, it was President Trump that accumulated 360 electoral votes to take 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, my former stomping ground. So, you know, it all comes down to travel in states. Where are the candidates going? It is no coincidence that, believe it or not, Trump and Biden are in the same city in Florida today, and it will be all about Florida. But over the course since the convention, where have candidates spent the most time? Pennsylvania is leading charge with nearly 25 visits, followed by Florida, North Carolina, Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So that kind of tells you where they've been, and I think gives you a pretty good window of where they will continue to go. Some of the lowest battleground states where the candidates have not spent as much time but could change, as you saw Senator Harris in Texas, have been Texas, Ohio, Nevada, and Georgia, which Georgia suddenly becoming into play. Another key thing to point out to the listeners is, you know, where are folks spending money on TV usually follows where are they traveling. So, you know, right now the Biden team has spent about $45 million this week on political ads compared to Trump's $15 million on political ads this week. In total, between 2019 and 2020, the Biden campaign has almost spent nearly over a half a billion dollars on advertisement, whereas Trump has spent about $342,000. And then the Facebook play is big. You know, since April through October, the Biden campaign spent about $200 million to place ads. Where were the top ads placed? Kind of reflective of where the top states that have been visited, and that would include Florida at nearly 300 million, followed by Pennsylvania. So the early vote, big deal. Nearly 74 million people have already voted, as you highlighted. That's comparing to what was in 2016 at this point, about 58 million. Currently, we're at a pace that about 7 million people throughout this country are voting per day. The top states include Texas at nearly 8 million total, followed by California, Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Texas, 8 million, Pennsylvania at 1.9 million, important to highlight. A couple of other key things to keep in mind is always, it always comes down to the money. And how much cash you have on hand. So, I mean, the Trump team is at a disadvantage here, and the Biden team has done a really good job of fundraising. So I think that's reflective of discussion I had on the ability to do the ads. But I think it also speaks to why President Trump wisely, and I think it worked effectively in 2016, is using not necessarily ad buys, but using these media events, the rallies, the visits, the free media events per se, to kind of double up on what the Biden team has been able to do with advertisement. So, you know, as you say, how to simplify this and make it easy on election night and what to watch for. I really think at the end of the day, it comes down to Florida. Florida polls will close at 7 p.m. that evening. Florida, unlike many other battleground states, will have already started to count some of the absentee early votes. And, you know, by 9 or 10 p.m., we should probably have a pretty clear sense of who won. The states that have been most problematic, and I think that's why you've seen some recent activity by the Supreme Court, Our states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, that won't start counting these huge volumes of absentee and early vote ballots until election day. So what you may see that, you know, could spur this debate of conspiracy is, Trump could easily pull off Florida, and then of the three states that I mentioned, could be leading in the votes because the absentee ballots and have not been counted. So on election night, you could see the scenario of potentially Trump winning Florida and leading in those three states until all of the ballots are counted, and then, you know, over the course of a couple hours or even a day, then the margins could drastically change. So, you know, what I'm telling everyone is it probably will be 3 or 4 days before we know an outcome, but it would be very hard for the Trump team to lose Florida and to regain a pathway to the magic number I mentioned before of 270. So with that, I'll stop, answer any questions. Also happy to speak on the Senate races and then talk about what the new Congress would look like.
Yeah, let's get into that in just a second. I want to turn to Jerry here, but just to clarify a couple things. So clearly you're saying that that Florida is key, and we could actually know, potentially we could know a definitive result on Florida on night of. And what you're saying is that if that goes Biden, the pathway to 270 really narrows very quickly for the president. If the president takes Florida, or if Florida is a too close to call type situation, then that's a signal that it's going to be a very long night and long week indeed. Just to follow up on your point about the following the travel and following the TV spend, there was news reports yesterday that the Trump campaign was pulling advertising in Florida or turning it over to the Republican Party. Is there anything to read into that, or is that sort of strictly procedural?
Yeah, I think that's more procedural. I think, you know, they're spending a whole lot of time in Florida. You know, there's a lot of rumors throughout D.C., and you'll see the president and the vice president kind of shift resources towards Michigan. So it will be interesting to see if some of those resources went to Michigan or Arizona or North Carolina or some of the other states. Maybe they're feeling much more comfortable about Florida, but too early to call. The only other thing I would toss out for consideration is I mentioned North Carolina, Arizona. They also start to count the absentee votes early, and they should have a pretty good sense. You know, the post close East Coast time at 10 p.m. in Arizona and North Carolina, the same as Florida. So, you know, if Trump were to be able to pull off those three states, then it's a long night for Biden. But if Biden wins two of the three that I mentioned, then I think it's a pretty good clear indicator of where things may stand.
So, Jerry, you've written, you've been a longtime observer of all this, and I think Orson did a great job here of laying out the landscape as it is right now, 120 hours out. And you've written extensively on the election and the variables that are going to characterize it for both the Times and the Journal. How are you looking at things right now? How do you see it?
Well, thanks, Kevin. Thanks very much for having me. As you say, it's a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to be on with you and Orson. The first thing I should probably say is in due sort of humility and in full declaration, I vividly remember doing an event with Teneo with my good friend Chris Waring, one of your colleagues, at almost exactly this stage 4 years ago, just before the election 4 years ago. And I was then editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal. Mark had invited, Chris had invited me and Mark Lazary, the CEO and founder of Avenue Capital, and a big Clinton supporter and fundraiser, a very prominent, very well-informed Democrat. He'd invited these two great pundits to speak to a group of Teneo executives about what was going to happen in the election. And when we were asked, both Mark and I said with a certain amount of confidence that Hillary Clinton would win the election. And I particularly remember at least one of the Teneo executives strongly disagreeing and saying we were completely wrong, that Donald Trump was going to win, he was going to pull out a surprise victory by winning in the key states. And Mark and I were politely, respectfully dismissive of that idea. So the first thing I should say is complete humility. Anything I say here is probably going to be, could well be contradicted by any of your colleagues, and indeed anybody else. They may have a much better insight into this than I do. So that's the first thing. I should just put my cards on the table there. I think I agree with pretty well everything that Orson said. I think with one exception, I think, and again, I'm talking here, and again, please, this isn't me particularly speaking. I'm speaking a lot this week with pollsters on both sides of the campaign. It was summed up for me very well by a text I got yesterday from a pollster who's advised Democratic candidates before and is now an independent pollster, who said he thinks it really does come down to Pennsylvania. To pick up on what Orson said about Florida, I completely agree. If Donald Trump loses Florida, it's probably over. But Florida, I think, is a what could be called a necessary but not sufficient condition for Trump to win the election. In other words, he could win Florida and very easily still lose. If he wins Pennsylvania as well as Florida, then I think he's very, very likely to win. Because if he wins Pennsylvania, the probability, he's further behind in Pennsylvania than he is in Florida. The probability is that would get a big state, give him 20 electoral votes, would probably give him enough to win. But he has to win Florida to have a chance. If he gets Pennsylvania, I think that Pennsylvania becomes the key state. And look, the reality of this election, again, just to sort of just to highlight what Orson was saying, is that Donald Trump is really playing on defense in this election. I'm a big football fan, a fan of football, both types of football on both sides of the Atlantic, and I've become a big American football fan. And you know, this election is being fought entirely inside Donald Trump's red zone. I mean, it's very much the Republican red zone. All the states that are competitive, frankly, are states that he won. He can't afford to lose more than two or three of them, depending how big they are. We all know the key states to watch are obviously Arizona, Florida, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Some of those states already, frankly, seem to be gone. I speak to people, they have different views on this. Michigan and Wisconsin are looking pretty tough for him. But if he wins Arizona, North Carolina, Florida, and Pennsylvania, then he will just pull out the narrowest of victories. There are other routes for him to get it too, but that seems right now to be the most plausible route for him to victory. So, look, I think I don't fundamentally disagree with what most people say right now, which is that Biden is a firm favorite. A lot of people, obviously, in reference to my opening remarks, a lot of people are very, very cautious about what happened in 2016, with good reason. There are very good reasons to be skeptical about what the polls are telling us. They got it wrong in 2016. I think there is pretty strong evidence that there is a significant Trump vote out there that is not picked up very well in polls. I think some of these polls, reflecting that difficulty. We had a poll in the Washington Post yesterday in Wisconsin giving Biden a 17-point lead, and anybody really thinks that's plausible, but it points up, I think, the problems that some of these pollsters have of picking up Trump voters who don't, like to spend a lot of time talking to pollsters, who don't perhaps, feel very good about coming out and speaking up in support of a president who gets, who has such a kind of a stigma associated with him. So I do think that there's a good chance, again, the polls are underestimating. But the key difference this time from 2016 is, the gap would have to be really large. Biden is now polling well ahead of where Hillary Clinton was in the national vote in 2016. He's now polling ahead of where Hillary Clinton was in the key state votes. Somewhat, not much, but by about a percentage point better than in those key states of Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Better than she was 5 days before the election in 2016, which means, again, given how narrow those results were in some of those states, that also augurs well for him. There are other factors, too. Biden is not Hillary Clinton. Frankly, he's a lot of voters are less objectionable candidate than Hillary Clinton. They know Donald Trump now 4 years on. So I don't, again, I think we could absolutely have a surprise on Tuesday night, Wednesday, Thursday, whenever we get it. But it does seem to me that it would to happen for Trump to lose, and we need to be clear about this, it would be an even bigger surprise, an even bigger shock. The polls would be even more wrong, especially in those swing states, than they were in 2016. And that could happen. It has happened. But I think right now you'd really have to, you know, I mean, I think the whole question of the future of the polling business would be up for grabs, because if they were that wrong, then it would be an extraordinary story. So I think that's right. I think it does come down to, again, I think Florida, he must win. And if he doesn't, it's over. Pennsylvania is probably, give the pun, but probably is the keystone for this whole election here. Because if Trump could win Florida and lose Pennsylvania, I think he still loses. If Biden gets Pennsylvania, even without Florida, he's almost certainly going to win. So that's where I'm watching the numbers, watching the polling that we've seen, the numbers that we've seen so far in terms of registered voters voting. And again, you talk to Republicans there, they are pretty optimistic. They say that they're doing better than the poll. The last polls seem to put the Biden lead in Pennsylvania about 3 or 4 points on average, some more than that. Obviously, some a little bit less. Republicans say they're getting out their vote very well. Turnout's going to be huge, as Orson said. Already, more than half the total number of people who voted last time have already voted. Turnout's probably going to be up above 150 million. That would be huge by American standards. So, again, I don't fundamentally disagree, but that's what I would say on Tuesday night. The key state to watch is probably Pennsylvania, because if Trump can't win there, it's an almost impossibly narrow path to victory for him.
So Jerry, just to, you know, Orson mentioned in his opening remarks that there have already been a number of court rulings, including at the Supreme Court, with regards to vote counting in the last several days and indeed several weeks, and there's more litigation coming. So if you're a lawyer who specializes in election law, I guess, you know, to use your football analogy, it's you're getting ready for your Super Bowl right here. But in a scenario where we do not have a clear winner next week, say on Tuesday night or even on Wednesday, how do you see things playing out? And I'm not just talking about in the legal sphere. I'm talking about, you know, in amongst the electorate.
Yeah. Well, I should say I'm a veteran of the 2000 election. I spent a little bit of time down in Florida after in that 37-day period. So we followed that obviously very, very closely. I mean, I'm one of the things I do remember everybody talking about in that Bush v. Gore standoff for 5.5 weeks. I remember Americans congratulating themselves, saying, look, we've had an election. It's a disputed outcome. We've had 5.5 weeks. It's all been completely peaceful. And, you know, it was all resolved legally and through the courts. And Al Gore stepped up and said, accepted defeat and all that kind of stuff. Aren't we great? Isn't this how America works? I don't find many people expressing confidence that we're necessarily going to have a repeat of that, should we have essentially what we had in 2000, which was a tied election coming down to a few hundred votes in one state. So I worry about that. You're absolutely right on the legal front is going to be extraordinarily frenetic. Should we, I mean, take Pennsylvania. So say it does come down to Pennsylvania, as I said. As you said, we've already had several court cases going on in Pennsylvania. We had a Supreme Court ruling this week on Pennsylvania, which essentially kind of passed and allowed Pennsylvania to continue essentially to allow for relatively late ballots to be filed, which is controversial. A lot of Republicans didn't like that. Incidentally, the Supreme Court, you know, went the other way, as it were, on Wisconsin, as we know, but that was for the very good constitutional reason that there wasn't a federal there was a kind of federal interest in what was being done in Wisconsin but not in Pennsylvania. So first thing, we absolutely will have legal disputes, and indeed the Supreme Court in its very brief statement on the Pennsylvania issue this week actually did appear to leave open, obviously, the possibility that there could be a review after the election, should there be contested ballots. Look, I mean, this phenomenon of mail-in ballots, without getting into too much detail about it and without, you know, going over the arguments about that Donald Trump has been, that mail-in ballots are subject to fraud, it is simply indisputable that when you have a lot of mail-in ballots, particularly in states that have never done it before on the scale that they're doing it this time, you have tremendous scope for irregularity and indeed for and the bigger problem, actually, rather than fraud, is error and the risk, the very strong likelihood that a very large number of mail-in ballots will be disallowed for completely proper legal reasons. Maybe the signatures don't match. Maybe there's no date on the postage. There's some other form of regulation. A lot of them do go missing. I mean, we saw that in primary elections here in New York just earlier this year. So the chances that there will, again, in a close race, which could come down, if it does come down to a few thousand votes in Pennsylvania, we will be going through, as we did in 2000, every single mailed-in ballot with everybody challenging whether or not that should be allowed or should not be allowed. So that's the first thing. There will be, as you say, a kind of Super Bowl for lawyers. Politically, and again, sort of going back to what I said about the relatively mild and subdued and peaceable response to 2000, politically, it is hard to see that we're going to have anything like a repeat of that. I think, first of all, you will have Donald Trump, who will be screaming from the rafters that he's been cheated. If the state of the count at that point puts Joe Biden ahead, and he'll be trying to throw out mail-in ballots and trying to throw out all kinds of other ballots, and will be jumping up and down and saying it's all a fraud. There are a lot of people who will believe that. A lot of people will, and again, it will be up for grabs to some extent. So there will be a lot of people who believe that. And I think we could, you know, politically, we've already seen extraordinary amounts of political violence this year in the United States, worse we've seen in 50 years in the United States. I fear that, you know, with people, with tensions running high, with people talking about this being the most important election, with people talking about legitimacy and illegitimacy and the future of the Republic, in those circumstances, why wouldn't they, why wouldn't some of them anyway, take extreme measures? One quick thing I would say, though, and I'll shut up, is while I think that is a real risk, I think if there is a disputed election, I think we could be in for prolonged political instability. First of all, I think that's probably unlikely. I think the election won't be quite as close as that, won't come down to as close as that in one or two states. Secondly, I am skeptical of this idea that, you know, the Democrats put about that Donald Trump is going to be somehow in the bunker in the White House, you know, so through December and January, and is going to have to be sort of, you know, he's going to start a civil war, and, you know, his troops will take to the streets, and the Proud Boys will be out there in their Fred Perry shirts, you know, causing mayhem. I've always felt that Donald Trump is a sort of a little bit of a Wizard of Oz character in this respect. His, you know, loud voice, tweets a lot, says angry things, says, you know, things that sometimes do look like they're in, you know, they're provoking violence. Doesn't actually, first of all, Donald Trump doesn't really have to follow through to do these things. It's actually not that. Really, he doesn't have the attention span to mount a political coup. The kind of, you know, it takes quite an effort to mount a political coup. He doesn't have the apparatus. You know, again, I joke about the Proud Boys. Obviously, there are armed people out there who would no doubt go out and do all kinds of terrible things. But he doesn't really have a political paramilitary political apparatus to do that. And thirdly, I think the Republican Party, you know, for all that it has been, you know, very much Donald Trump's party for the last 4 years, if the result is clear, again, it's important to distinguish between a clear result and one that's contested. If the result is pretty clear, they are not, the Mitch McConnells and the other senior figures in the Republican Party, and I think also Republicans in the states, are not going to sit back there and kind of watch as Donald Trump takes this country to the brink of civil war. I think they're going to say, you know, Donald, and by the way, I think including some members of his own family too, will say, Donald, you know, you lost, the time's up, it's time to move on, and so forth. But I do agree that should the result be, we get a rerun of 2000, essentially, where it comes down to a few hundred or a few thousand votes in one state, then we are going to be in for, you know, what could be some quite serious political instability for some time.
Yeah, I think those last several points are really important. I think it will come as a great relief to a lot of people on the call to hear you say that. Before I move back to Orson, I just wanted, there was a follow-up question for you from a member of our audience, which was, you made the point about the potential for the pollsters to be wrong. That would be the second major presidential election in a row, and they might as well pack it up and go home. This is a point Orson has made on the call before as well. The question is, do you have any sense you know, that there's been improvement in the in polling technique and polling control for these shy voters?
So they say there has, right? So I mean, some of the changes that have been implemented since 2016, much more use of telephone polling. I think one of the problems, by no means the only problem, one of the problems that we saw, particularly in 2016 in previous polling, was the use of a lot of internet polls. And those have tended to be less reliable. It's well, I mean, there are arguments about that, actually. I mean, as it turned out, some of those polls were very unreliable in 2016. There is an argument now that actually these, you know, when people are actually on the phone and speaking to someone, they're even more shy and even more reluctant to express their support. But by and large, I think pollsters, you know, who've been doing this for a long time, think that provided the internet, provided the phone polling is made up of the right questions, you will get the right results. Things like changing the way in which they ask questions in ways that don't necessarily seem to be likely to prompt a particular response. They've done that, changing the ordering of questions. Many pollsters have reduced the number of questions that they ask, whether it's an internet poll or a telephone poll, because they, you know, some polls were, I think even earlier this year, were still asking 40, 50 questions of people, which of course people tend to lose interest, and you're only going to then get the people who are like really politically interested, who often tend to be not particularly Trump supporters, for example. So they have made some change. There's no question they've made changes. They've made changes to the way in which they sample, obviously, the sampling techniques that they use, that filter that they use to get from registered voters to likely voters to actual voters. They've made changes to all of those things. So there's no question they took on board. And obviously, one thing that should be said is that, you know, the national polls in 2016 were not that far out. The final national polling average in the Real Clear Politics average in 2016 gave Hillary Clinton a lead of about 3.5 points. She actually won by just the popular vote by just over 2 points. So it was kind of within the margin of error. The real error came obviously in the state polls, where Hillary Clinton was leading in all of those key states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, I think even Florida, which she ended up losing. So they have made changes. I think in good faith they've made changes. They've tried to do this. I just still think there is a. I think the risk is, have the changes they've made been enough to counter the fact that if anything, probably the shy Trump voter problem is probably larger this time than it was 4 years ago, because people have seen Donald Trump for 4 years. You know, even Trump supporters disapprove of his behavior, right? You ask people whether they like Donald Trump personally, you get a 60%, 65% negative answer. So there are a lot of people who don't like Donald Trump, don't like what he does, don't like what he says, who are still going to vote for him. That's even larger than it was in 2016, because we had a chance to see that. So I think that's the risk here, that shy Trump voter, the shy Republican voter, the person who refuses to speak to pollsters because they're all part of the mainstream media and they're all biased, that is actually potentially a larger problem this time. And even the efforts that pollsters have made to remediate the problems that they had in 2016 may not be enough to do that. But again, we'll see. And if they're wrong again, then there will be a fundamental soul searching going on among the pollsters.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm 51 years old. I've been a registered voter since I was 18, and I've never been called by a pollster. I want to move beyond the election itself and ask you guys a couple questions, given the potential outcomes here. And Orson, you know, let's assume for a moment that Biden wins and the Democrats take control of the Senate. In that instance, how are you advising, how would you advise our clients in the event of a Biden victory about how they should be thinking about the lame duck and transition period in terms of what they ought to be looking for in terms of staffing and in terms of cabinet, in terms of what the likely first 100-day agenda will be like? And also, you know, this gets into the weeds of what a lot of our clients have to think about every 4 years, how they are involving themselves in this process. I imagine it will be a very atypical inaugural celebration week in January, regardless of who the winner is, given the pandemic. How are you going to be advising clients on this?
Yeah, great question. And just to circle back to something Jerry said that I think is important. Let's not try to predict an outcome on who's going to win here, because the last 4 years have been highly unpredictable, you know, related to COVID. Thinking in February, if anyone on this call or on this line really thought that Joe Biden was going to be the Democratic nominee, and for those who might have been on the call, and Kevin can attest that there was a few of us out there who predicted Trump victory, but, you know, 2020 has been a year that has been totally unpredictable, and I would suspect before it's done, there will be several more things that we'll look upon in 2021 and say, wow, never saw that coming. To get to your question, you know, I think our clients in general and people in DC, where I am, the swamp, are probably more focused, as I mentioned, on the chambers of Congress, who controls the Senate, how that works out, some of their public policy priorities. A lot of corporate America is really concerned, which Jerry spoke to and others, about, you know, if this is contested, the chaos that could consume our communities, you know, whether there will be store closures, you know, our people in direct contacts with their local police departments, do they have those connections? Have they reached out to the governor? Is there a general plan? And then there's a lot of talk about, you know, people still have to go to work in some cases and communicate with each other. And those politics often breed into the workplace. So, you know, how do you manage internal discussions around the election? And then more importantly, how do you speak to your consumers who may want you, particularly those who are consumer facing, to have a point of view? The hard question, of course, will be, one is send congratulatory notes and reach out directly to the presumptive nominee. This one will be a little tricky on timing when to send that. And then you talk about the transition. Transition, like the campaign, I think, regardless of which side, is going to be complicated as the inauguration. I can't imagine there will be a transition office that will be having meetings with people. You're looking at a virtual transition team, virtual transition meeting, and potentially a virtual surf, per se, into the White House. So, you know, the big thing right now is the Biden team for corporate America is not accepting any corporate checks or political PACs for its transition for those who may want to support it. And I'm sure they may carry that into whether or not corporate America will be able to be supportive of what could be a virtual inauguration. A lot of clients are thinking about which think tanks will be on the top and on the bottom. You know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has taken some political heat on the Republican side for supporting Democrats for the first time in some of the congressional races. If the Democrats take both chambers, will, you know, they be rewarded? Will you see a shift? And people are re-exploring, you know, memberships such as the BRT and others who have had great relationships with the Obama administration and the Trump administration, but I think, you know, they will be reading the tea leaves carefully, particularly on the cabinet piece, to see which group and association may have the most influence. And then, as always, and I do this daily, you know, who will fill the new cabinet? And it sounds as though if Trump is reelected, there will be those who may be departing, and the Biden cabinet will bring in an entire new team. And bringing in an entire new team brings in an entire new circle of influence. So a lot of discussions on who knows who, and I would imagine those discussions in the coming days after election will intensify. You know, the lame duck, the first 100 days, everyone's talking about. From a corporate perspective, I hear a lot of focus on when might the Biden or the Democratic Senate reconsider rolling back some of the corporate taxes that, as they see it, have benefited corporate America. And of course, I have to think that following the election, that the House and the Senate, if they do anything during lame duck, will immediately address not coming to some sort of compromise on a COVID package, particularly helping the unemployed with financial support. A couple of other items I'll just close out on is, as new administrations come and go, so does staffing. A lot of discussion on not only who knows who, but do I have the right team to be able to achieve the results needed, not only in Washington, but at a state and local. So I do think there will be a sea change potentially in DC of heads of GA offices, as there always are following an election. And then, you know, a lot of clients are concerned on this Buy America and connection to labor, what that means. And I'll close, which I think is probably the biggest item most discussed, regardless of who wins, is, you know, because of COVID, I think Congress and the new administration is really going to take a harsh look at the American supply chain, and particularly through the lens of China, on how we might be able to make adjustments. So as they see it, we don't have some of the deficiencies we had with PPE and other items because of COVID. So, you know, those are a few things, but it all comes down 120 hours from now on who wins. And I'm sure when we have this call again, I'll be able to throw out 30 or more other items that people are concerned about.
Yeah, and that last point about the supply chains being an issue that they'll want to address irrespective of who occupies the White House. I guess, Jerry, you know, let's imagine for a moment the scenario where Trump wins a re-election here. What do you expect then in terms of, again, maybe the same question as to that I've just put to Orson regarding how they will use the lame duck period, and also early in the new administration, given that there was no new platform presented at the convention, other than to sort of reload the 2016 platform and express essentially de facto fealty to the president. But what would you expect?
Well, I think as with everything with Donald Trump, he'll wing it, right? I mean, you're exactly right. There is no sort of formal platform. I mean, as we know, those platforms are less prescriptive lists of things that actually get done in government than they are kind of statement of broad intent by the parties. But even so, even allowing for that, there isn't one. I think it's going to be interesting. If Trump wins again, it's going to depend on the circumstances in which he wins. Sorry to get back into the weeds of the kind of post-election morass that we might find ourselves in, but supposing Trump wins, if he wins, he almost certainly will not win the popular vote. Okay, so if he wins, and if he does win, he will probably win the electoral vote by less than he won it last time, which was quite narrow last time. He won 306, you know, what he needed, 270 last time. So let's say he gets somewhere between 270 and 306 electoral votes, just enough to win. And this time, very likely to lose the popular vote. He lost by two, just over two last time. He could lose the popular vote by four or five this time. So I think the first thing that you'll have will be unfortunately, a bit of a crisis of legitimacy if Trump wins. A lot of Democrats will, frankly, you know, they were angry last time. They'll be angrier this time. They'll think this is completely unacceptable. This is a rigged system. You know, how can you have, by the way, it would also be worth remembering, you know, the sixth time of the last seven elections when Democrat has won the popular vote and lost. Democrat has won the overall popular vote, and it will be the third time in the last four Republican victories that they've won the Electoral College vote while losing the popular vote. So I think you'd have to allow for the possibility that, no, and now there's some extreme talk here, you know, California would immediately, you know, begin legislation to secede from the United States, or you know, there'd be people would sort of refuse to cooperate with the federal government. I think that's nonsense. I think in the end, you know, people understand that for all their frustrations, there are certain practical considerations that just have to be met, and things will go on. But I think there will be a massive political crisis of legitimacy. I think there will be, you know, resistance, if I may use the term, that would sort of, this is what we've seen over the last 4 years, I think will get worse. I think the media, frankly, my colleagues anywhere other than the Wall Street Journal and Fox News and one or two others will describe this as an illegitimate result. So look, do I think there'll be a huge political problem Just like, you know, if Trump does win in win, and the likelihood is if he does win, he wins in those circumstances. So in terms of getting anything done, first of all, in the lame duck session, look, I think there will be, this will be driven in large part by just the severity of the crisis, right, of the COVID crisis. If, you know, numbers, obviously, case numbers are picking up all the time. Thank God the death rate doesn't seem as bad as it was earlier in the spring, but that is picking, that number of deaths is picking up too. Exactly as Orson said, you know, the additional unemployment relief has run out now. That could, you know, if we do see significant further lockdowns over the next few months, over the next month or two, that I think will increase pressure on the two sides in Congress to come together and produce at least a minimum package of, you know, at least on the unemployment benefits front, maybe on some checks, probably not on the support for states if Trump has won, but some additional targeted support for airlines and various other things like that. So I think some kind of slimmed down stimulus package, if the facts on the ground of COVID and the economy are deteriorating in the way they look likely. So I think you can expect something like that in the lame duck session. And again, I do think, unfortunately, I think because of the, if Trump does win, the terms on which he wins, I think you can expect, you know, some really significant political challenges. You know, again, I'm not remotely going anywhere near the kind of secession talk or civil war talk, but I think the sense of the United States as a cohesive nation, able to function as one nation, I think will be seriously brought into question if that happens. You know, it'd be a completely legitimate result. That's the Constitution the founders gave us with the Electoral College, but I think we've already seen a challenge to that in the last 4 years. I think those challenges will get greater if Trump were to win again in the similar or arguably even more extreme circumstances.
So we've got about 10 minutes left, and there's so many other things I wanted to talk to both of you about, but frankly, I think there'll be plenty of time to talk about what it all means after the election. So hopefully, Jerry, you can come back at some point in the future. But I do want to take advantage of the fact that you're here today and ask a sort of a broader question, and that's about the media. I mean, you've had a long time senior role at one of America's premier newspapers, the bellwether of the center right to the New York Times' center left, and certainly America's premier business newspaper. And so I guess my question to you is, you know, how you view the role of the mainstream media and the role that they have played, you know, over the last 4 years, and as polarization has increased and so on and so forth. I mean, we'll put the extreme, you know, internet news and all that kind of stuff off to the side here for a second, but talk about the real important media organizations in the country and how you see things changing, or if they need to change. But also, if you could talk a little bit about what you think will happen in the event of a Biden presidency, in which case I think we all expect that the sort of, you know, the news cycle coming out of the White House is going to be a lot, you know, it's going to be a lot more sedate versus what we've had over the last 4 years. And so but clearly even the New York Times has certainly benefited from a business perspective by the Trump presidency. So do the news organizations need to keep the volume pumped up to 11 for business purposes? Or how are they going to essentially spend their time? And for corporations, does that mean that the investigative lens is going to be turned in a much more significant way, again, back toward the business of America?
So there's obviously a lot there, and I'll try and be brief. Look, I've written about this, including just in my column in the Journal this week. So some of this may not come as a surprise to anybody. Look, I think what we have in the media today, it's been steadily going on for 20 years, and I think it's now been supercharged in the last 4 years. I think essentially you have a partisan, almost completely partisan media. I think you have Democrat, left, progressive media like the New York Times, CNN, frankly, most of the networks, and you have conservative media, yeah, as you say, maybe, I mean, Wall Street Journal editorial page, although not the news pages, Fox News, Breitbart, that kind of thing. And I think, you know, again, we can get into long arguments about the extent to which the media has always been biased in a particular direction, which I think it has. But I think there was at least an attempt for most of the last 30, 40 years to try and sort of play the role of a kind of relatively neutral, at least appear to be a neutral umpire, at least appear to be sort of calling balls and strikes. Now, you know, they've essentially, you know, stripped off the umpire's uniform and are, you know, pitching or catching in a way that we haven't seen. So I think we have a fundamentally completely partisan media, driven to some extent by partisanship, you know, in the country at large, but driven importantly, and you touch on this, Kevin, and I think this is important, and I mentioned this in my column this week, so I will elucidate on it a little bit, driven in, very much in part now by the business model of news organizations. And as you said, I was editor of the Wall Street Journal, editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal for almost 6 years, and deputy editor for 4 years before that. Over the last 10 years, I've seen the transformation of the business model of newspapers. Now, again, in a picture of general gloom for traditional news organizations, particularly newspaper, there are some news organizations that have stood out and done successfully. We are one at the Journal. The New York Times is undoubtedly another one. Washington Post, arguably a bit different because it's privately owned, obviously, by Jeff Bezos, but still has done quite well in terms of reach. The business model has shifted. 20 years ago, you know, I was like, we never published these figures, you know, officially, but everybody knows now that 20 years ago, the Wall Street Journal, for example, about somewhere north of 80% of its total revenue was advertising. There were days, I'm told, I wasn't at the Wall Street Journal then. There were days in the glory days of the late 1990s, before the internet had really taken hold as a source of commerce. The Wall Street Journal actually had to turn away advertisers every night, because it didn't have enough physical space to print the advertising they wanted to print in our newspaper. We just didn't have the physical capacity to fill the newspaper, to put the ad, all the ads in the newspaper that there was the demand for. You know, glory days, sadly, long, long gone. So from 80% of revenue, advertising is now in organizations like my own, I can't speak for my own because I'm not privy to the final details, but is dramatically south of 50%. We are talking for most newspapers for 40, 30%, something like that, is now funded by advertising. That advertising has obviously gone primarily to get Google and Facebook on digital, and Google and Facebook have the lion's share of that. What that means for the business model of news organizations, and forgive this long digression, is that they've become much more dependent on subscribers. We at the Wall Street Journal have done a brilliant job of this. We've increased our subscriber base. When I took over as editor in 2013, we had total subscribers of about 1.6, 1.7 million. We're now north of 3 million. We're closing in, actually, I think, on 4 million. The New York Times has gone from 1.5 million over the same period to 4 or 5 million. And these are paying subscribers, people who pay, in the Wall Street Journal's case, paying, this, I hope you're all Wall Street Journal subscribers, as you know, and thank you very much if you are, a significant amount of money. It's most people pay an average of $300-$500 a year for a Wall Street Journal subscription. So we are required to be much more attuned, and the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times are required to be much more attuned to those readers, because they are providing the revenue. We are trying to grow, and the New York Times is growing successfully by appealing to people to part with their own money. It's not advertisers, their own money to subscribe to the newspaper. So they need then to appeal to those people and to what those people are interested in. And there's no question in the New York Times case, we're a bit different because we're a business newspaper. And, you know, again, I think we're fortunate in that respect, in that, you know, we don't really, conservative pages, the editorial page is conservative, but the news pages don't need to lean in such a direction because the bulk of our focus at the Journal is business. But if you're the New York Times, the bulk of your focus is general news, politics, culture, all that kind of stuff, or the Washington Post or the LA Times or pretty well any other newspaper in America or in the world, you are on a daily basis getting feedback from your subscribers about what they're getting. And in the last 5 years, the growth in subscriptions to papers like that has come heavily from people who despise Donald Trump, who think Donald Trump is Adolf Hitler Mark II, and who want to see the media bring down Donald Trump, preferably at least in an election, and if not before an election through impeachment or something like that. So they have created kind of Frankenstein's monster, in my view, for themselves, which is that they've become these hyper partisan, these audiences of hyper partisan people whose interest is not in, you know, they don't want to read anything about Joe Biden and what his son may have done in China. They don't want to read anything about, you know, whether Joe Biden is up to the job of being president or what Kamala Harris's, you know, political credentials are. They want to read stuff about how evil Donald Trump is. And you know, okay, we get a Biden presidency. There is a view, and I've spoken to some people at the New York Times and elsewhere about this, that things will kind of revert to normal in a way. That's very unlikely. You have, again, this pressure from subscribers. You have pressure from a new class of journalists at these organizations, which is very liberal, very progressive, doesn't really see journalism in the old traditional way of being objective and neutral and all that kind of stuff. Sees journalism as a cause and sees the newspaper they work for as moral causes with a mission to change the world. That's, again, the logic, the business logic, the cultural logic, the political logic points us in that direction. So I think from the point of view of your clients, Kevin, I think, you know, you will see newspapers becoming increasingly, you know, interesting. It's a paradox. Their circulations, like the New York Times, are growing dramatically, but they're speaking to a smaller and smaller overall proportion of the country. They're speaking to people of a political viewpoint that is only half of that, that is maybe half, maybe slightly more than half of the country. So I think it's going to be an interesting question. You know, do those, you know, for your clients, for people more generally, you know, what do those newspapers, I'm not here speaking against the New York Times. The New York Times has done extremely well and has followed that model very, very well. But I think it is, we are going to see something akin to the newspaper model that Britain has had for a very long time, which is highly partisan newspapers. And also for those who kind of throw their hands up in despair and say, woe is us and the Republic is finished. Remember, this is what newspapers were like in the early days of the Republic. I've gone back and read those articles, so-called news articles that were written in the 1790s and early 1800s. They were as partisan as anything you ever see on CNN. You know, some of the things that were said about Thomas Jefferson or John Adams by their opponents in newspapers were even by today's standards of Donald Trump, pretty well unsayable. So I think, you know, we go through these phases in American journalism, in American media, and I think we're going into that phase. And again, I don't know what the implications are for everybody, but I think we are going to see increasingly newspapers that appeal to particular audiences, that do very well, that build a good business model out of that, but which I think become less important in terms of getting at the truth, if I may say, such a sort of highfalutin thing. They're less objective in terms of getting at the truth, and I think probably less effective in terms of reaching the larger audience of Americans.
We have just a minute left, and I want to ask you one last question while I've got you here. And of course, everything you just said, the opposite is also true on the other side. You know, with ultimately with your own employer, with the Murdoch Empire and their hold over the right. But I guess my question, and maybe there's actually a coming together of these last two questions in a sense. In the event that Biden wins, what do you think happens with Donald Trump, and mostly about the voice that he has and the platform with which he'll use to, you know, to amplify that voice? How do you see a post-presidency for him and what that'll mean to a Biden president?
Well, there's one view is that he'll run again in 2024. I find that very unlikely. As I said earlier, I just don't think Donald Trump has the attention span for this kind of effort, and he'll obviously be significantly older in 2024. There is another view, which I think is probably closer to the truth, which is that he will take his voice and his platform and try to make money out of it. That's what Donald Trump has done quite well, depending on who you speak to, but done reasonably well over the years. And I think he'll try and do that. And he probably, you know, will try, you know, perhaps in alliance with a more traditional media, someone with more experience, direct experience of media. I think he probably will try and do that. Again, I'm a little bit skeptical about that, because again, I'm sorry, I keep coming back to Donald Trump's personality. It takes a lot of effort and creativity and work and patience and diligence to get, you know, I mean, Rupert Murdoch launched Fox News in 1996, and it was not until about 5 or 6 years later that it really started to become hugely influential and important. I just don't know that Donald Trump has the patience to do that kind of thing, but I think he will probably try. And I think, you know, and again, I think there will be, you know, there'll be a ferment on, and I'll finish very quickly with this. In larger terms, there'll be a significant intellectual ferment on the right. There will be those who say Trump was a disaster and we need to kind of go back to the Republican Party of Mitt Romney and John McCain and all of that. I don't think that will get very far. There'll be a Trump view, which is that I was cheated. I was cheated by the media or by whatever, and I've got to get back. I don't think that will get very far. I think the sort of force that will emerge, the intellectual argument that will emerge and will generate real political support will be one that that kind of tries to marry the populism of Donald Trump. Because again, whatever you think of Donald Trump, very hard to argue that, especially in things like foreign policy, his view of, you know, pulling America back from engagements in the world, that's pretty popular. And I don't see Joe Biden fundamentally changing from that either if he becomes president. The Republican Party is not going back to the neoconservative George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, approach of the early 2000s. That's gone. They won't do that. And I think the missing piece for Republicans, even under Donald Trump, which I think will start to become evident in the next few years, is an economic populism. Trump was very good at articulating, you know, I'm going to take on the swamp and these people are not on your side and all these companies are shipping jobs to China. In the end, though, Trump didn't really do very much about that. And as we know, okay, we can have an argument about what exactly his effect his China policy had. He didn't do much. He didn't do anything to reverse the dramatic increase in corporate power in Washington, the extraordinary increase in concentration in the US economy, which has resulted in sector after sector being dominated by a small handful of companies. And of course, it's been glazed over a little bit by the fact that we've seen increases in wages in the last few years, but the long-term trend of really dramatically increasing inequality in the country. I think there are more and more Republicans, and I'll just leave you with this thought, with these names, there are more and more Republicans who are embracing that idea that what you need is not just nationalist populism and you know, bring the troops home and we stand for America and we're against globalization and all of that stuff. I think you're going to get an economic populism, and I think you're going to hear it from people like Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, Tom Cotton, to some extent, the senator from, he's more hawkish internationally, Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, Ben Sasse from Nebraska. There are very important figures, I think, are coming up in the Republican Party, young, thoughtful, bright, populist, very ambitious. And I think the party, again, faced with defeat, if it does happen next week, and faced with this choice, this range of choices, I suspect that if I can put it in sum, it's kind of Trumpism without Trump is the kind of message they want. That is, populism, nationalism, more emphasis on the people being left behind, more emphasis on taking on the elites in the media and tech and big business, but just without the kind of endless circus of Trump and tweeting and narcissism and everything else that comes with it. And I think actually it could be quite a powerful combination.
Have to bring this call to an end. I want to thank you very much, Jerry, and you know, for anybody who's on the call, if you needed to establish your bona fides to opine on American politics, you certainly your proper use of American sports metaphors only established how well you know America right there. And Orson, thank you very much as always, and certainly to our clients on the line in these closing days. If you have any questions regarding the election and the outcome and what to expect and what that means for you, please don't hesitate to reach out to Orson and his team. Please don't forget to vote. If you're still on the fence about who to vote for, I don't know at this point. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with our next Teneo Insights call. In the meantime, if you have any follow-up questions, please reach out to your Teneo representative, or you can email us at TeneoInsights@Teneo.com. So thank you again very much, everybody, for joining us today. Thank you, Orson. Thank you, Jerry. Have a great day, everyone, and all.